Thank you. So, has anyone got any money? Great. I need 5, 10 or 20 pound notes. Oh, great. That was easy.
Anyone else? Oh,
20 pound note. Were you primed beforehand by the last congregation? Anyone else? Got? Oh, great. Excellent.
Got a fiver. Excellent. Thank you very much.
So, fiver from Brad, £20 from Jeff. Just making no comment on that. Who would like to take this money and tell me whether it's counterfeit or not? Who thinks they can tell? Well, the money came from this side, so we'll give it this side. Who's going to tell me if it's counterfeit or not? What do you think? The real deal. How do you know? What are you looking for? A feel of it. Okay. Anything else? The look of it. What are you looking for? Everyone can chip in. There's no pressure. Yeah? They're brilliant. There's holograms. And they're really difficult to fake, aren't they? Oh, you're holding up to the light for the watermark? Brilliant. There's a watermark. That's really difficult to... Silver strip, thank you. Is there a silver strip? Yeah, and you can see it runs right through. Otherwise, it's just a silver dotted line that they print. Yeah, and the feel of it, you're right. There's raised printing, isn't it? Bank of England is slightly raised. Great. Well, there we go. You can now choose your response to being given the money. Keep it. The collection plate is coming round at the end of the service. So... it's totally up to you. Can you spot the counterfeit? Do you see the marks between the real thing and the fake thing? Our passage this morning is about wisdom, a passage where the writer James is painting a bold contrast of wisdoms. There are two types of wisdom, says James. There's godly wisdom and there is worldly wisdom. And James is writing this letter to the early churches against worldly wisdom and teaching them in our section to see the marks of authenticity, to be able to discern the counterfeit, the fake, the inauthentic, from the real thing, wisdom that is of God and from God. There are hallmarks to look at. There are silver threads. There's a look and a feel to godly wisdom that if you know what you're doing, you can see it. So think about your life, the things that are challenging you most. I bet they're not things that are challenging you most. I bet they're people that are challenging you most, situations, decisions. Relationships are inordinately complex in their dynamics, aren't they? Decisions that are needed where the reason they're difficult decisions is because it really is not clear at all what the right thing to do is. In today's age, we have all the knowledge we need quite literally at our fingertips or thumb tips. But wisdom is rare and priceless. How can we navigate a wise path through those complex decisions and dynamics? Don't we need wisdom individually for friendships, for family life, for workplace and community and neighbourhood? We need wisdom. We need it as a church. We've got a big PCC tomorrow night, our church council meeting, the big decisions on resources and the future and finance and children's and youth ministry and staffing. We need wisdom. We need wisdom for the nations of the world who think for one moment about the global stage and how much we need wisdom so that humanity can flourish as God intends. And so here's James's question to us this morning, chapter 3, 13. Who is wise and discerning among you? He asks. And the Spirit asks of us this morning, who is wise and discerning among you? Do you know the marks of genuine wisdom so you can live in it? Well, I'm going to summarize under 2 points. First hallmark to look for, first silver thread and watermark is this: deeds, not degrees. Godly wisdom is not shown in how many university degrees a person has, but the good deeds you are choosing to do. Verse 13, show by your good life that your deeds are done with the gentleness that is born out of wisdom. The culture we live in confuses being clever for being wise, doesn't it? We prize cleverness over character. Our education systems are built around this. We value cleverness, the accruing of knowledge, passing exams by being able to regurgitate vast amounts of knowledge that we've crammed into our brains. There is no necessary connection at all between knowledge and understanding, knowledge and wisdom. And we mustn't confuse being bright or becoming clever or being regarded as intelligent with actually being wise under God. They can be very different things. The last 30 years have been an exciting time to be alive. When I was a kid, if you wanted to find something out, you walked 20 minutes to the library and you looked it up in an encyclopedia. Like, literally, that's what you did when I was 10. Or if you were rich, your family had a set of encyclopedias and you could, you know, look it up. But the information revolution has been, it's been cool to live through a revolution, because you read about the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution. We've lived through a revolution, and for all we know, this is the very early days of it, the last 30 years. I saw some launch of new software, voice recognition stuff, and artificial intelligence is coming out. It's amazing. And this phone, you just said, oh, book me a table for four in a restaurant, and the piece of software phones the restaurant, and in a computerized human voice that you could never tell came from a computer, has a real-time, proper human conversation with a real person on the restaurant. And the sophistication was mind-blowing. And that's coming to us, you know, it's ready now. What about moral advance, though? Have we got off the ground yet? Even an inch off the ground, humanly speaking, in terms of total depravity? Controversial question. I would say no, when you look back over 30, 300, 3,000 years. Who is wise and understanding? Let him show it by his good conduct. James says, look at a person's deeds, not their degrees. What do godly deeds look like? It's there in verse 17. Things done with gentleness, actions and attitudes that are full of mercy and good fruit. Someone who is an active peacemaker. Got a track record. And wisdom here has all to do with relationships, because you can become very clever on your own. You can write books on your own and amass knowledge all by yourself. But you can't become wise on your own, because wisdom is inherently relational. The field of wisdom, the playing field, can only have more than one person on it, if that makes sense. It's all about relating well to others. And so verse 13 is a really sobering challenge. Don't show me your wisdom by waving your CV and your exam results at me. Show me your wisdom in the written out pages of real life, your actions, how you relate. Counterfeit wisdom appears clever, but it erodes healthy relationships. And now, this was really strong stuff for the people who first received this letter from James in the first century. They're in a Greco-Roman culture, and they've had centuries of a tradition of a group of people called the Sophists, the wise. They were sort of philosophical thinkers and speakers, and they engaged and debated publicly on issues of truth and reality and ethics and morality, and they were paid to do that, and it was a whole school and a thing that was very common in the cities. But still today, particularly in the UK, I think worldly wisdom, we value eloquence really highly, don't you think, in our culture? And if you speak with a certain accent, if you are fully of sort of witty repartee and entertain everyone at a dinner party with how sort of quick you are, and you can bemuse people, we're really impressed by that, aren't we, in our culture? And if you can, you know, win your trophy of debating society at university and stand up in the House of Commons, and with one line you can kind of slap down the opposition with your wit and retort. We're so impressed by these people. And they convince us, just like the Sophists, the wise ones of Greek-Roman culture. And God isn't impressed with that, James makes it clear. He chose Moses, with his speech impediment, to be the great teacher of the people. He sent Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, who was ridiculed mercilessly for being rubbish at oratory. Paul didn't compare well at all to the sophists. And Paul says, I don't come to you with wise or persuasive words, but fear and trembling. But imitate me because I imitate Christ, because he's living it out in real life, and that's wisdom. Now, there is a spiritual gift of teaching, and there is nothing wrong with any of God's people being good communicators. That's my caveat. Otherwise, it'd be really ironic to be... I've spent a week working on a message to stand up and say, that's pointless. It's not pointless. But biblical wisdom includes thinking and speaking, but the emphasis is on acting, is on doing, is on deeds. That's the hallmark. So being a disciple of Christ, if you want to follow Jesus, it's not about scholarly expertise. A disciple of Jesus is an apprentice to Jesus, is a real practical person, hands-on, faith in action, living it out. So if you want to know if someone's wise, don't look at their hourly fees that they can command for their work. Don't look at the number of letters after their name. Don't look at the volume of journal articles they've had published. Read the book of their life. See their good deeds, their merciful kindness, and watch them be a peacemaker. And there you will find wisdom. William Taylor writes this: the test paper of godly wisdom is the track record of life. Worldly wisdom says you can actually draw a line between professional achievement and private conduct. Worldly wisdom says there's a difference between end-of-year results and the means by which those results have been achieved. We see this division from time to time. You know, you get in the papers, Member of Parliament has been photographed with a prostitute, and then the sort of radio talk shows and the letters pages of the newspapers will have a debate about whether they should resign or not. And you always get a great number of people saying what this person chooses to do in private is none of our business and has no bearing on their public role. Have you heard that? Not so for James. The test paper of wisdom is the track record of life. Thinking, speaking, and acting. Deeds, not degrees. Secondly, humility, not hubris. The second hallmark of godly wisdom is humility. And these early Christians had to be taught something that was, for them, profoundly countercultural. We might hear the word humility and know, oh, that's a good thing. But not for these guys. They'd been taught that humility was, in their culture, it was no virtue at all. Humility was regarded in their society as slavish and low and servile. And the Stoic philosophers name humility as the number one moral fault. And James says humility is the hallmark of a wise life. Verse 13, godly wisdom is meek. Verse 17, godly wisdom is gentle and willing to yield to others. It's hard to live humbly because the world conflates humility with weakness. And in our culture, weakness is bad. I imagine we can all think of a family member or a colleague who will never concede a point. They will never admit that they were wrong. They don't want to appear foolish, but actually the opposite is true, because it is wise under God, James says, to be willing to yield to others. There was a great cartoon Steve earlier in the week reminded me of, because in the age of social media, we've got endless opportunity for debate with others. And this cartoon, it depicted a wife in her pajamas late at night going to her husband, who was sort of at the office with his laptop in their home, and saying, darling, when are you coming to bed? And he says, darling, I can't come to bed. Somebody on the internet is wrong about something because you're just on some kind of forum still at it with a total stranger who you're never going to convince. It's pointless. Are we learning to yield wisely to others? Verses 17 and 18, true wisdom is submissive, it's open to reason, impartial and sincere. Now, there are some essentials that you don't give way on, but generally, we can do better at yielding. Wisdom is humble. How do we show it today? I think often it's as simple as the difference between the people who talk all the time and the people who listen and question. Wisdom is questioning. Wisdom is listening. because that is a great sign of humility. Counterfeit wisdom, the fake thing, is hubris. Verse 14, someone might sound clever, but what's going on in them is envious, selfish ambition that leads to boasting and lies, hubris. And this comes from what we all have, an inbuilt desire to get to the top of the heap, because we're kind of conditioned into survival of the fittest. I heard last week on the radio about an aeroplane company, and they were running on the ground some safety tests, and they wanted to test this aircraft for the time it takes to evacuate the aircraft in an emergency. So they'd filled it with, you know, volunteers and taught them the evacuation procedure, pressed the alarm, and then timed and blocked off one exit so that people had to move around and work out how to get out, because that was important, obviously, to do some role-playing of the emergency procedure before they actually flew this thing in the sky. But it didn't work very well because people listened to the instructions, and then when they pressed the buzzer, people in a sort of orderly fashion got up and made a British queue and exited the aircraft. So they tried a different contractor because they wanted something a bit more realistic. And the next time they ran the evacuation test, it was absolute chaos. People were scrambling over each other. They were climbing on seats. They were disregarding the rules. They were leaving the weakest people behind. What made the difference? The woman heading up the test had told the participants that the first person to get off the plane would be given £10. I mean, it's kind of depressing, isn't it, that that's all it took? She was able to create real-life emergency simulation. And people having no regard for the weak, every man for himself. It's in all of us, that selfish ambition to be the top of the heap. It's worldly, James says. Verse 14, there's bitter jealousy. People who want what other people have got. And that competitive envy in school, in the home, in the workplace, in church. When someone else gets asked to do something that you had had your mind on that you would be asked to do, there's that envy. We find it with siblings when they're small. Sometimes mature grown adults are still harboring that bitter root of envy. And there's a bitterness because there was a brother or sister who got treated differently, or got a better job or a career or a more successful life, whatever it is. In politics, it's been an interesting week. Verse 14, self-seeking pursuit. I'm not mentioning any names. Selfish ambition. In the Greek language, selfish ambition is a really rich kind of word, and it comes from when you wanted people to work for you, so you go to the marketplace and kind of round people up, workers for the day. And so selfish ambition has this sense of rounding people up for your cause, cajoling people, manipulating them into achieving what would promote you. Backstabbing, disorder, plotting, conniving. I'm sure we don't see any modern parallels of this at all. And James is really black and white about where this comes from. Verse 15, that kind of conduct is demonic. So, to conclude, perhaps a band would want to come up at this point. We hold up a mirror to our own lives, and where does this teaching leave us? Does it leave us feeling failures, a bit hopeless? James asks, who is wise and understanding among you? And none of us can volunteer our names for that list, can we, really? But there is great news. Who is wise and discerning among us? There is one. 1 Corinthians 1 declares, Jesus is the wisdom of God. Jesus is the wisdom of God. Wisdom is a person. There is no hint of selfish ambition in him. He was pure, full of mercy and peace, without a trace of hypocrisy, no favoritism, no hubris, total humility. And so wisdom comes to us, not just as the perfect example to follow, but as we saw this week with the boys trapped in the cave in Thailand, wisdom comes not just to be with us in our darkness, but to rescue us from it. And in rescuing us from our cave, Wisdom himself lays down his own life that we might be free. So a life of godly wisdom doesn't have to be a remote ideal. It is offered to us as a person, a reality to follow, that we can live with and grow in. Would you like to stand to pray?